Siegfried is a Norse hero, one of the most demanding roles in all opera. He slays dragons and has to sing about it in Götterdämmerung, the twilight of the gods, the last opera in Wagner's Ring cycle. New York's Metropolitan Opera is currently presenting Götterdämmerung, now starring the famously demanding role of Siegfried as a singer who was understudy for the part until just a few months ago. J. Hunter Morris joins us from the Metropolitan Opera. Thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, I'm so pleased to be with you. Thank you for having me.
First of all, you were born in Paris.
Yes, sir. Paris, Texas. It's not exactly a breeding ground for opera singers or classical musicians, but I feel like the luckiest kid in the world to grow up down south and have the upbringing. There were not a whole lot of indications that it would lead me here to the stage with Metropolitan Opera.
Well, how did you get to know opera?
Well, you know, I sang my whole life. My father was a Southern Baptist music minister, and my mom was the church organist, and I did all the things that every other kid in America does. I sang in the church choir, and I sang in high school in the rock and roll garage bands, and I wasn't really good at anything. I was okay at a lot of things. I moved to Nashville after college, and was pursuing, some gospel and some country music. I was very involved in ministry back in my youth. But I didn't really have a fire or much of a passion for any of those things. And a friend took me to see Traviata in Dallas. And I was so mesmerized by the whole process. And that I kept asking my friend the whole night, oh, wait a minute, are you sure they don't have microphones? I mean, we're in a 3,000-seat house, and this lady's laying on her back singing. I don't understand. How can she use her voice like that? I was so fascinated by the whole process. And, you know, I hung around afterwards, and I talked to the cast as they were coming out. And if you can believe it, the tenor was Alfredo Kraus, who is, you know, a legendary singer and a kind gentleman. And he pointed me to a fella that I went and had a voice lesson with, and Mr. Hayward said, you know what, son, you might have a voice in there. You know, it's going to take a little work, but if you want to come here and work with me, we'll see what we can do. And it really has been my love for this art form that has propelled me forward, and it's thrilling.
Let's listen to a little bit of you, if we could.
Okay.
What shape was your career in, say, a couple of years ago?
My phone over the last 5 or 6, 7 years was learning not to ring. And I got, a few things here and there. I'd got some small roles. But, you know, I felt like I was in the twilight and that things were quite possibly grinding to a halt. And I got an offer from Spate Jenkins a few years ago. He said, look, son, I know you probably don't know Siegfried, but I think there's a chance that you could sing this well someday, and I'm going to give you an offer. I'd like you to be the understudy here in Seattle when we do it. And I said, yes, sir, thank you very much. I would love to, because it was really the only card on the table, and you just take it a day at a time, and that's what I've been doing really for 23 years. I've been just taking little baby steps, getting a little better, getting a little stronger, getting my throat to obey me a little bit more every day. So here I am. Mr. Simon, let me tell you something. Learning this thing is a nightmare. It is so long. It's so hard. And, you know, you might have picked up that German is not my first language. So, you know, it was a massive undertaking, and I just thought I would never learn it.
You still follow country music?
Yes. Guilty as charged. Yes, sir, I do. I listen to country and I listen to jazz and gospel, too.
I wonder, any chance for mixing genres in your career?
Let it be. In the words of John and Paul, let it be. Absolutely. You know, if I'm honest with you, I dream of having an opportunity to get to sing some country music again someday.
J. Hunter Morris from the Metropolitan Opera in New York is currently playing Siegfried in Wagner's Ring Cycle. Thanks so much. Good luck to you, Mr. Morris.
So nice to meet you, Scott. Thank you.
The Met is broadcasting Gotterdammerung in HD at select theaters around the world today. Places like Mexico and Pakistan often receive attention for being violent, but according to the United Nations, the world's most violent country is now the small Central American nation of Honduras. The U.S. Peace Corps has even withdrawn its volunteers. Drug trafficking, political instability, and Honduran history have all contributed to the problem. The first of a two-part series on violence in Honduras, Annie Murphy reports on police corruption.
The National Autonomous University is the largest university in Honduras. It's a sprawling campus of concrete buildings and tropical plants. It's filled with students on break between classes. They sit on benches, drink bottles of soda, and chat. But here, tucked in between the palm trees, some are gathered around a homemade memorial to two murdered students, Alejandro Vargas, the son of the rector of the university, and his friend Carlos Pineda, who were killed in October, not by Honduras's notorious gangs or drug traffickers, but by the police. The memorial is a long roll of white paper taped to a wall, where friends leave photos and write messages in colored marker. Isaac Trejo is skinny and tall, and he lingers with his hands in his pockets. Despite the heat, he wears black jeans and high tops. He says violent run-ins with the police have become commonplace.
It's normal, and everybody knows it. They don't respect the law. They can go and attack anyone they want. For them, the rules don't exist.
While police violence is commonplace, this case is high profile, and it's galvanized Honduras, largely because of who Alejandro Vargas's mother is. Within sight of the memorial, his mother, Julieta Castellanos, sits in her office. She has dark hair cut right at her chin and soft hollows under her eyes. In addition to working as the rector of the university, she's a widely respected expert on violence. She became part of the commission that took on the case of her own son's murder. She says it met strong resistance.
The police obstructed the investigation. The head of homicides threatened the prosecutors on the case. He's the person who is in charge of investigating murders. And he told the prosecutors that they had to stop investigating, that they didn't know what sort of trouble they were getting into.
Eight officers were arrested, but the police released four, despite striking evidence. The investigation found Alejandro's blood and hair in patrol cars. Tape on security cameras showed the boys being followed by police shortly before they were killed. And area guards testified that they heard gunshots right after they heard Alejandro's friend, Carlos, begging the police for mercy. Castellanos.
Y en respuesta, Carlos fue trasladado con vida.
Their response was to take Carlos, still alive, along with the body of my son, because reports show he was dead by that point, 13 kilometers south of the city where he was killed too.
For 25 years, Maria Luisa Borjas was a high-ranking police official and was eventually put in charge of investigations within the force. She says she was pushed out of her job, her son's thrown in jail, an attempt made on her husband's life, when she began to uncover just how serious police corruption had become.
Everyone here knows that each day young men turn up dead with their hands bound and the famous execution shot to the base of the skull. And the majority of people that come forward, they say that it was the police that had taken those young men away.
The government says it's doing everything it can. Following the murders, high-level officials were fired, and the military was also sent into the streets as part of a move called Operation Lightning. Security Minister Pompeo Bonilla.
Not all the police are bad, but unfortunately, we do have to accept that corruption is a reality. because in the last 3 years, Honduras has become a major stop for drug trafficking.
But according to Berto Oliva, the head of the Honduran Human Rights Commission, it's about much more than just drugs. She says today's problems go back to the 1980s, when the United States was using Honduras as a base for training and arming groups to fight leftists in the region. Disappearing people became part of our security culture, she says. We were supposed to have been living in democracy, so that's what our democracy became, she says, one that kills and tortures its citizens. Officials who were trained during that era still influence how the police and military are run today, say both Oliva and Borjas. And the U.S. still gives aid for law enforcement, with at least $50 million going to Honduras since 2008.
Nosotros no lo creemos. Lo hemos pedido.
We've asked the U.S. to stop giving aid to security forces here, and we're going to keep asking them to stop.
In an interview, U.S. officials declined to comment on tape, but they pointed out that times have changed and stressed that today the relationship with Honduran security forces is totally different because all aid is tightly controlled and legal, things like training and materials. But even Honduran Security Minister Pompeo Bonilla says that the Honduran government is in over its head.
There's been a lot of aid, but it hasn't been well coordinated. We haven't established clear and precise guidelines for ourselves. We don't have a security policy in this country.
Which is why many here, including Isaac Trejo, that classmate of the murdered students, believes Honduras is on its way to being a failed state. At some point, the police will totally lose legitimacy, he says, and you're going to see even more lawlessness. That's when a society breaks down. And once that happens, he says, the state itself loses legitimacy, and that's what is happening here. For NPR News, I'm Annie Murphy.
And Annie Murphy's series continues tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Dave Isay begins his latest book with words from someone he used to work with. She had a charming, meaningful name, Lily Love, who died in 2010. And she said, "Love is all there is. When you take your last breath, you remember the people you love, how much love you inspired, and how much love you gave." Lily Love worked with Dave at the Atlanta office of his StoryCorps project. Their new book is All There Is, and it is a collection of love stories and recollections. Dave Isay joins us from our studios in New York. Dave, thanks for being with us.
Scott, always great to talk to you.
So let me get the high hard one out first. What have you learned about love from all these folks?
You know, I think in general, when you read this book, when you listen to these stories, one theme that keeps coming up is that no one should ever, ever give up hope on love. And you see that in these stories over and over and over again, that, you know, it seems like it's not in the cards for people, and then it just sneaks up behind you, and there it is.
Let's play an excerpt from one of these stories, if we can. Paul Wilson, who's now 93 years old, relates the story of how he met his wife to his daughter, Marty Smith.
One day I was waiting in the lobby for the elevator. The door slid aside, and there she stood. The prettiest girl I had ever seen. She was the operator. There were three or four other people on the elevator, and I was the last one on floor number 10. And she opened the door, and I said, "Thank you." And she said, "You're welcome." That was the total conversation, that first contact. Of course, in the next few days I saw her, but I was so backward and bashful that I didn't say anything to her except 10. She said, "Yes, I know." Thank goodness she broke the ice. She said, "Do you know where you can get some good chop suey? How about that for an opening line?" I said, "Sure. The cafe across the street is a Chinese cafe. They serve chop suey."
I sensed that she set that up.
I realized later she did. And we had chop suey, and we got acquainted. We got married right there in my mother's living room, and we had a 63-year honeymoon. And as you often say to me, when we part company, you say, "Life is good." And I have to think, yeah, life is good, even though I've lost my sweetheart.
Who was it that said the best thing a man can do for his children is to love their mother?
I did my best.
You did.
We were real lovers. And every day is a memorial for her.
Paul Wilson telling his daughter, Marty Smith, about how he met her mother. Boy. You have to take a breath after that.
I think most of these stories aren't sad, but people always talk about these stories, making them cry. I think that it's because, you know, you're hearing something authentic. You're hearing people speak from a place of honesty and generosity. Nobody's looking for 15 minutes of fame. Nobody's looking for anything but to kind of express their love to another human being and talk about what's meaningful in their life.
Let's play a clip from one story. Grand Kestenbaum, 63, tells her friend Darlene Griggs about the husband she lost and loved.
He fell on me at a party, and I thought he was the goofiest guy I'd ever met in my life. He had a shirt that was so rumpled and a pair of shoes, one of which had many rubber bands wrapped around it because the sole was coming apart. Some weeks later, he called me. He said, "Hello, this is Howie." And I said, "Howie who?" He said, "Fine, thank you. Howie you." And I just thought, I can't walk around with this guy. The next year, in June, we were married. And then for 31 years, we were together. And he started asking me, maybe 6 weeks before 9/11, "Do you love me, honey?" I said, "You will always have my deep and abiding love." And I don't know why I said that. I'm glad I did. He's always going to be 56 in my mind. I'm going to be an old shriveled up mass, but he will be 56.
Dave, I don't think I know anybody since the late Ann Landers who has listened to more love stories than you at this point. On behalf of a lot of people, what do you think makes love work?
It's clear from reading these stories that it's about honest relationships. It's about people who deeply connect to each other as human beings. It's about not settling for anything less than what feels right. You know, there's a story in the book, and it's an 85-year-old guy talking about his wife. They were driving through Philadelphia right when he came back after World War II and saw a roadside sign. It said, "Successful marriage," things, you know, to always say to your loved one. "You look great. Can I help? Let's eat out. I'm sorry. And I love you." And, you know, he says that those guided their marriage for 53 years, 2 months, and 5 days. And that pretty much sums it up.
God, gotta find that sign.
No.
Dave Isay, his new book is All There Is, Collection of Love Stories from StoryCorps, speaking from New York. Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
You know, scientists can spend years working on problems that at first may seem to many people kind of pointless. For example, there's a researcher in Arizona who's trying to find a way to measure the age of, mosquitoes. But as NPR's Joe Palca reports, if it's successful, the work will not only be professionally rewarding, it could have major implications for human health.
There's a nasty disease called dengue that's just beginning to show up in the United States. It's caused by a virus, and it's transmitted from person to person by a mosquito. A mild case of dengue is no worse than flu. A serious case can mean death. Michael Reilly is at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's trying to solve a curious puzzle about dengue, why there have been dozens of cases in nearby Texas and none, or virtually none, in Arizona. Reilly thinks the answer has to do with Arizona's geography.
It's right on the edge of the range of where these dengue mosquitoes are found. It's a fairly harsh environment, and we think that they might not be surviving long enough to efficiently transfer the disease to other people.
So to test his hypothesis, Reilly wants to be able to compare the lifespans of mosquitoes in Arizona with those in Texas. It's not easy to tell how old a mosquito is. It's not as if they carry around birth certificates or government-issued IDs. Right now, the tools for measuring the age of a mosquito are pretty crude. For example, you can look at a female mosquito's ovaries to see if they've produced any eggs. Reilly says if they have, that means the mosquito is at least 5 days old, since they can't produce eggs before that.
But that's all it can tell us, less than 5 days or more than 5 days.
So Reilly has a new idea. He wants to see if he can use a mosquito's genes to tell its age. There are ways to tell when a particular gene is switched on or off in a mosquito. Reilly is looking for genes that switch on or off when the mosquito reaches a particular age. He's found one. He needs more in order to make more accurate predictions. To help in his search, Reilly raises mosquitoes in a special climate-controlled room down the hall from his office.
So this is the basic insectary. This is a level 2 containment facility, so the mosquitoes won't get out.
The insectary is about the size of a large closet with metal shelves floor to ceiling. This place is a Tupperware salesman's dream. The shelves are stuffed with plastic containers in a variety of convenient sizes. Reilly points to a largish container. Inside are what look like tiny wiggling worms swimming around in a couple of inches of water.
There's a whole bunch of pupae in there that you can see.
Mm-hmm.
These will all come out in the cage, and then after 2 days of allowing them to hatch in there, we'll know the exact age of the mosquito.
Knowing its age gives him a precise starting point to see how or if different genes change over time. If he can find genes that change with age in the lab, Reilly can look for the same genes in wild mosquitoes and use them to estimate the wild mosquito's age. This work has implications for a number of mosquito-borne diseases. Malaria mosquitoes have to live at least 2 weeks or so before they can transmit the malaria parasite. Knowing more about the age of wild mosquito populations could help prevent, or at least predict, outbreaks of disease. But the search for age-related genes is going slowly. That's not terribly surprising. In science, you usually have to go down a lot of blind alleys before you find what you're looking for, if you ever do. Reilly says it's a lesson students coming into his lab have to learn.
You give them a project, then they just expect it to work and have no problems and get their results by the end of the semester, and they're on their way. And it's always interesting to see them learn that, a lot of science is failure and building upon what doesn't work.
So it's not failure itself that's bad, it's just not learning anything from your failure.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Actually, what we call failure a lot of times leads to new lines of discovery.
So really, we'll continue to search for genes that will reveal a mosquito's age. And with persistence and enough failures, he thinks he'll find them. Joe Palca, NPR News.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Kwasi Kwarteng is in some ways a child of the British Empire. His parents were born in Ghana when it was subject to British rule. They eventually emigrated to London, where Kwasi was born. He eventually ended up at the finest boarding school, Eton College, and then to Cambridge, where he studied classics. Kwarteng worshipped Margaret Thatcher as a boy, and today he's one of just 4 Afro-British members of Parliament who's a conservative. Now, in another era, Kwasi Kwarteng may have been the ideal British civil servant, sent to the colonies to administer the Queen's Empire. But Kwarteng is also an historian and one who's just written a scathing critique of that vast enterprise. It's called Ghosts of Empire, and in it, he focuses on 6 places the British administered, all places still coping with the aftermath of British rule.
If you look at Nigeria, where we've had flare-ups of religious conflict, we've had suicide bombings, we've had lots of people being killed.
This is Muslim-Christian.
That's a Muslim-Christian thing. But if you look at the actual geography, if you look at the map of Nigeria, you'll see that the Muslim area is in the north and the Christian area is predominantly in the south. This is reflects almost a tribal basis, if you like. And these problems essentially stem from the fact that the country is an artificial country. In fact, the term Nigeria appeared in a Times op-ed piece in 1897. So these artificial boundaries essentially set up a very tense situation in which different ethnic groups, different tribes were forced to come together where they had no real shared culture.
And we face those consequences to this day.
Absolutely.
You point to Kashmir, for example.
Well, Kashmir is a fascinating instance where the Hindu royal family was sold Kashmir in 1846.
Even though the majority of the population was Muslim.
Exactly, because this man, a man called Gulab Singh, had managed to ingratiate himself with the British. He'd managed to do well in the Sikh Empire, which controlled Kashmir previously. And the British didn't really want to rule Kashmir directly at that time. So they sold it to him. As a consequence of that, his family ruled Kashmir for 100 years. But when it came to independence, the Maharaja had the sole choice, and he decided, as a Hindu, to go with India. And, of course, that had massive consequences, which we still feel today.
I'm interested in your relationship with the story you write about because, of course, you are the child of immigrants, right? Your parents are from Ghana, and you, in some ways, are a product of some of these elite institutions that many
Absolutely.
Of these, right? You're an Oxbridge kid and
That's right.
Harvard Kennedy School, and now you're a member of parliament representing the Conservative Party, the party that many, I guess, would associate with tradition, these kinds of people that you write about. And I'm curious to get a sense of how you came to the Conservative Party.
I've really been drawn to the Conservative Party largely through Margaret Thatcher, the inspiration of Margaret Thatcher. And my conservatism is very much, if you like, an economic conservatism. I'm very much interested in free trade, in commerce, in wealth creation. In terms of empire, I think, if you look at the Conservatives' relationship to empire, yes, it is true. My family were probably victims, if you like, of a lot of the imperial tradition. But, you know, we've moved a long time, I think, from that time.
Did you grow up, I mean, did you, when you were growing up, did your folks talk about how their worldview and the world in which they inhabited was shaped for good or ill by empire?
Yes, I think they did. My parents were born in the early 40s, so that's a very important date because when Ghana, which was then called the Gold Coast, when it became independent in 1957, my parents were just finishing their high school. So that was a very formative age in which they were taught very largely by British teachers. And then as they left high school in the late 50s, the schools they attended became more Ghanaian in influence. So they were there right at the cusp. So obviously that shaped their views. And I heard a lot of stories about the old colonial times. I mean, my father remembers listening to the London Olympics in 1948 in his village on the radio. These kinds of memories were part of my experience growing up.
Those are complex memories, though, right? I mean, I've experienced this as well as an overseas correspondent where you meet people who remember empire and they remember things about it fondly, like your description of your father listening to the BBC. It's not just black and white.
It's not exactly. I mean, this is what I'm trying to say is that yes, there was a lot of exploitation, but in a country like the Gold Coast, people often forget that there were very few colonial administrators. The British were trying to run, certainly after the war, the empire on the cheap. The hand of government, if you like, was quite light. So if you went to Accra, which is the capital, you might see a few British officials. But in the villages and the countryside, they were much rarer. So people very much got on with their lives, almost as if the British weren't there in some parts of the empire. Now, that doesn't say that it was a kind of land of milk and honey and they did not feel that there was an alien force, if you like, in their country. But it does mean that some of the memories are quite fond.
I'm speaking with Kwasi Kwarteng. He's a conservative member of the British Parliament and the author of a new book called Ghosts of Empire. It's interesting because one of the main points you make is that democracy and the promotion of democracy cannot be exported. And you cite the example of Hong Kong, where you write about how this kind of parallel world of a British-style social hierarchy actually came about, not a liberal democracy. Can you describe
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Britain was in Hong Kong from 1841 to 1997. That's 156 years. During most of that time, the first 140 years, democracy was a sideshow. And in fact, one governor tried to bring in a little bit of democracy after the Second World War. That was completely overturned. That was not a path on which Hong Kong, as far as the British were concerned, should develop. And that's, I think, a very good example in which empire, while it could have imposed law and order, which it did in Hong Kong, was not about spreading democratic values. And in fact, I quote a civil servant in Burma. He said, "Forget all this rubbish about democracy. We're not trying to make the average Burman into a Brit. We're not trying to bring them political consciousness. We're simply trying to make sure they get a square meal and that there's some kind of law and order." And that was very much what I think the empire in reality was about.
What about, I guess you could call it the Monty Python argument, right? The famous scene where it says, "What have the Romans done for us?" You know, roads, bridges, wine, so on. I mean, that's an argument that people like Neil Ferguson and others who say, you know, there are things about empire that gave us the world we live in today, and we should be grateful for that. What about that argument about infrastructure, about roads, order?
Obviously, I mean, that's one of the points I make. I mean, I say that there was a degree of order, and yes, there was quite a bit of infrastructure development. What I'm arguing against is this idea that you could export some sort of political idea of democracy.
It seems to me that when you were writing this book, you had another empire in mind, and that is the so-called American empire. I mean, do you think that in some ways the United States and the way it operates overseas has learned lessons from the UK or has in some ways ignored them?
I think a bit of both. I think actually, sure, when I started writing the book, I was very much living under the influence of current events. The Iraq War, which started in 2003, had happened. We're still living with the consequences of that. And the whole notion of neoconservative ideas of exporting American values, that was on the political agenda. And my book was very much, if you like, a response to that. And I think given the drift of American policy in the last 2 or 3 years, certainly with the election of Obama, I think the Americans are now much less inclined to try and export their values in that aggressive way.
That's Kwasi Kwarteng. He's a historian and a conservative member of the British Parliament. His new book is called Ghosts of Empire. It's out now. Kwasi Kwarteng, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
A couple of hours ago, we recorded history with an engineer named Casey Hopkins from Portland, Oregon. In 15 seconds, in 10 seconds, you will be a millionaire.
Well,
Casey and I were furiously refreshing a website called Kickstarter, where more than 12,000 people went to give him their money, $1.4 million of it. At 3 this afternoon, the funding became official. Here you go.
Boom. The best things in life
are free. You're good to go.
Pretty surreal.
Casey's the first person ever to collect $1 million from Kickstarter. It's a website that helps entrepreneurs fund their projects with help from donors. And for Casey, it all started when he got an idea to build a new, better iPhone dock, a little charger stand, because he didn't like any of the ones he found in the store.
They're these little plastic pucks, and they don't work if you have a case on your phone. And they're so lightweight that when you go to grab it, the whole thing comes with it.
So Casey designed his own, one made of solid aircraft aluminum, and it doesn't move around when you take your iPhone out of it. He calls it the Elevation Dock, and he put his appeal on the Kickstarter site back in December.
Then it just exploded across the internet. We hit that $75,000 goal in 8 hours. In 24 hours, we had $168,000 in pre-orders.
People want this thing. Casey's received orders from retailers all over the world, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia. He's also promised an elevation dock to every person who contributed $59 to the project. And everyone else, well, they can buy one for about $90, but they'll have to wait until later this year. Well, Casey, I'm going to let you go because you don't have a whole lot of time. You got to make 15,000 docks, man.
That's right. Nose to the grindstone.
That's Casey Hopkins. He's the founder of Elevation Lab and the creator of the Elevation Dock. His idea raised $1.5 million on Kickstarter. Casey, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.